All the best Bitcoin works read aloud so that you can listen. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy with Guy Swan. This is the Audible for all things Bitcoin. I am jumping into a piece today. Sorry for the little bit of a dry spell on the episodes, but we are hitting another one from Unchained Capital. I've been kind of going through a lot of the pieces on this blog recently because I've been trying to catch up. This is titled All 21 Million Bitcoin Already Exist. And I think it actually leads a pretty fun dynamic to the idea of whether or not the halvings are priced in when you frame it this way. And this is by Phil Geiger. I will link to all of this stuff in the show notes and in the Twitter post so you can follow Phil, Unchained Capital, obviously, and check out the actual article. But without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into this piece and we'll talk about it afterward. All 21 million Bitcoin already exist. By Phil Geiger, October 25th, 2019. Quote, every piece of money is owned by one of the members of the market economy. The transfer of money from the control of one actor into that of another is temporally immediate and continuous. End quote. Ludwig von Mises, Human Action. To celebrate the 600,000th Bitcoin block, which has unlocked the 18 millionth Bitcoin, and in an effort to become increasingly fun to be around at parties, I'm writing this exploration of the idea that all 21 million Bitcoin already exist. This may seem like a semantic or esoteric argument, but Bitcoin is truly a different beast, which requires closely evaluating the assumptions we make and the language we use when describing it. By more clearly defining Bitcoin and how it functions, we can speak more accurately about its monetization process, which ultimately will help hodlers spread the word to our pre-coiner friends and family. We are alive for and witnessing the greatest event in the history of economics, the rapid monetization of a scarce, apolitical, global currency. Providing our communities with an early competitive advantage could have positive long-term implications if Bitcoin survives. Misnomers already run rampant in Bitcoin, such as the terms wallets, addresses, and mining. A Bitcoin wallet is more closely related to a key ring, or a public and private key generation coordination factory. Bitcoin addresses aren't really locations that we want users to repeatedly visit, unlike physical addresses or email addresses. Mining is a similarly incorrect term. This is where I believe much of the confusion arises when evaluating Bitcoin, and is where much of the FUD surrounding Bitcoin focuses time and energy, because it's easy to misrepresent and is extremely confusing to newcomers. There are a few questions and assumptions that we will need to explore in order to understand whether all 21 million Bitcoin already exist. Is it possible for a computer program to HODL BTC? What are the different inputs required to make a Bitcoin transaction? Why would people choose one transaction method versus another? When did all 21 million Bitcoin exist? What's the difference between the available versus unavailable supply? First, we need to understand what is unique about Bitcoin's supply compared to the supply of another hard currency. Let's start by comparing Bitcoin to another monetary good, gold. Bitcoin supply versus gold supply. It's most accurate for us to say, based on what we currently understand about physics and the elements, a majority of the supply of gold, AU, in the universe already exists, with nuclear fusion producing some additional supply over time. The crucial difference between the supply of gold and Bitcoin ultimately comes down to what people are capable of knowing about the supply. Due to the expansion of the universe and the universal speed limit, light speed, humans have no way of estimating the total supply of gold, since its location is unknown and it's likely that a majority of the supply is very far away. On the other hand, we have extremely strong social and technical consensus surrounding Bitcoin's total supply, as well as the exact current location of the locked supply. In fact, we have more information about the BTC stored in upcoming blocks than we do about the currently unlocked supply stored in the blockchain. We know exactly how many Bitcoin will move as a function of the Coinbase transaction of discovered blocks, yet we have no way of knowing if a person currently holding, say, 1 million Bitcoin, is going to broadcast a transaction in a given moment to convert all of their Bitcoin to another currency. Bitcoin are unlocked on a set supply schedule that auto-corrects itself via a difficulty adjustment every 2016 blocks in order to maintain the schedule. This allows us to know with extremely high levels of certainty exactly where the currently locked 3 million Bitcoin live, block number, and with slightly less, although still extremely precise, knowledge about when they will be available for spending by private key, on average, every 10 minutes. The difficulty adjustment is the feature that harnesses individual incentives to perpetuate Bitcoin's own growth. By aligning difficulty to network size, it thwarts people's effort to create more supply and instead uses their effort to increase security of the network. Theoretically, we can know where all of the gold on Earth is located, but we have no way of knowing precisely when we can get to it, the cost to extract it, or precisely how much gold exists beyond Earth. As such, we can make the assumption that if gold ever becomes valuable enough, we can and will find a way to uncover more of it for use, either by mining on-planet or off-planet, or by harnessing nuclear fusion to create more. This is the nature of supply and demand. If demand for a good or service becomes high enough, it increases the incentives for people to go out and produce more supply. The Bitcoin network itself is its 21 million supply. The supply is a vertical line in the supply and demand model, meaning it's completely inelastic. This limit is written into the code that all full node operators choose to run, and more importantly, it's the limit we all agree to when we purchase our first Bitcoin. It has nearly unanimous social consensus. In Bitcoin's history, there have already been multiple technical inflation bugs discovered, and one inflation bug exploited, but the network ultimately viewed those transactions as an invalid minority hard fork and maintained the socially understood supply schedule, even though it required node operators to run patched software. It's reasonable to expect we will see more software bugs like this in the future, and once again, the network will have to rely on social consensus. Luckily, the network's incentives are all designed around socially and technically maintaining this 21 million limit. A Twitter poll by Phil Geiger. Full node operators, assuming a Bitcoin inflation bug is exploited in the future, what do you do? Fix the bug and accept the extra Bitcoin? 9%. Give up. Bitcoin is dead. 7%. Fix the bug. 21 million Bitcoin or bust. 83%. Full node operators are pretty convicted about the 21 million limit. The outcome of this poll would be Bitcoin competing with a minority coin, obviously to be named Bitcoin Inflation. With gold, there is no way for a technical or social consensus to manage supply. There is only the element AU, and there is no way to know when and how it will be mined and accessible for human use with any reasonable amount of precision. In gold's case, we can use supply-based predictive models to measure the future supply. We can't know how much gold exists in the universe, only that it's difficult to mine additional supply here on Earth. We can model how quickly we expect the supply of gold to inflate, assuming demand remains relatively steady. So, then what is Bitcoin mining? In Bitcoin, there are two ways that people are allowed to transact. The first way is what the majority knows and loves, private key authentication. If a person holds a private key associated with a funded address on the blockchain, They are able to move the funds by publicly broadcasting a signature from the private key and including a fee to incentivize the network to purchase electricity and process the transaction. In order to obtain the funded address in the first place, someone somewhere must have expended productive energy to obtain the Bitcoin. The second way that people can transact Bitcoin is by selling electricity in the form of SHA-256 hashes to the network, what we colloquially and incorrectly label as mining. By converting the cheapest electricity into as many SHA-256 hashes as possible, these Bitcoiners are ordering and proposing batches of pending transactions by finding the valid SHA-256 hash of the block at the current difficulty level. If their ASICs are able to find the solution before others, and their proposed blocks are validated by the full nodes according to the rules, miners can move the block's Coinbase transaction, often referred to as a miner reward, and the block's transaction fees to any address they'd like. Do miners create new supply in this scenario, or just transact known Coinbase transactions and transaction fees by spending electricity in the form of SHA-256 hashes? Twitter poll. There's overwhelming social and technical consensus that there will only be 21 million Bitcoin. This limit is written into the rules your node currently follows. Miners produce new Bitcoin supply, 24%. Secure this policy, 30%. Both, 28%. Neither or other, 18%. We're pretty split on this. 52% believe miners create supply in some form. 48% believe they do not create supply. There's a good chance this poll was worded poorly. It's a subtle yet important difference that, in my opinion, allows us to say authoritatively that only 21 million Bitcoin can possibly exist. The question is somewhat of an individual decision that each full node operator and holder needs to make. Node operators individually do not get to define what is or isn't Bitcoin. They can only validate whether a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin, and they individually are either in consensus or out of consensus. That said, when we reach block 630,000 at the next halving, will your full node accept 12.5 Bitcoin, or will it only accept 6.25? My node will reject any future block that attempts to spend a Coinbase transaction that doesn't follow the supply schedule written in the code my node follows. Because this would be an invalid transaction according to the social and technical consensus that I opted into. Through a distributed network of individuals making personal decisions like this, the market ultimately decides what is valid Bitcoin, and the market has to date objectively set Bitcoin's limit to 21 million. If a computer hashes alone in the woods, does anyone care? Converting electricity into SHA-256 or any other algorithm hashes is an inherently unproductive activity, unless it is in the service of something valuable. Converting electricity into hashes for the Bitcoin network is productive and profitable because Bitcoin holders value using electricity to secure the network, as long as the miners abide by the rules of a consensus of holders and full node operators. For individuals interested in selling hashed electricity to the network for the opportunity to transact Coinbase funds and transaction fees, mining, there are only a few rules that are absolutely fixed. The most important rule is that there are only 21 million Bitcoin. The next rule is that the number of Coinbase transaction Bitcoin started at 50 Bitcoin in 2009 and decreases every 210,000 blocks until all 21 million Bitcoin can be spent by private keys by 2140. After that, the hashed electricity purchases the ability to transact only the transaction fees paid by users broadcasting private key initiated transactions. Luckily for miners, the difficulty adjustment by design always ensures that it is profitable for someone to sell efficiently hashed electricity to the network. If a given miner is unprofitable long term, they must make the decision to either shut down their business and possibly sell their hardware on a secondary market, or to find a cheaper source of electricity. If enough miners are unprofitable and shut down their ASICs, causing the network hash rate to drop and blocks to be found on average longer than 10 minutes, the difficulty adjustment recalibrates itself to the new lower hash rate to ensure the supply schedule is maintained. As a result, the Bitcoin network adjusts itself to always pay market price for electricity converted to hashes, depending on the value of the network. If a given miner is unprofitable when selling electricity to the Bitcoin network, simply means that they are being outcompeted by other, more efficient miners. Given these absolutely rigid network rules, savvy miners will quickly recognize that if they can get their electricity costs close to zero, maybe by producing electricity cheaply and choosing whether to sell it for other uses or as hashes to the Bitcoin network, they can effectively sell hashed electricity to the network profitably forever. It's the value of the currency, not the number of units. Quote, it must be pointed out that the level of the total stock of money and of the value of the money unit are matters of complete indifference as far as the utility obtained from the use of money is concerned. Society is always in enjoyment of the maximum utility obtainable from the use of money. Half of the money at the disposal of the community would yield the same utility as the whole stock, even if the variation in value of the monetary unit was not proportioned to the variation in the stock of money. End quote. Ludwig von Mises, The Theory of Money and Credit. After Satoshi found the Genesis block and Halfini and friends agreed to participate in the network according to the rules set forth in the code, and more importantly, the social consensus, all 21 million Bitcoin instantly popped into existence in a Big Bang moment. Each early user that converted electricity to hashes to transact early Coinbase transactions received private key access to a large number of, at the time valueless, Bitcoin, as well as the understanding of the rules that future holders and miners can transact the locked supply of Bitcoin by submitting electricity as hashes to compete and solve for blocks of transactions. In this way, we can look at the value of the locked Bitcoin as though it is distributed and held equally by every participant in the network. This value is paid by the holders to miners for submitting hashed electricity to the network at the market rate, measured by the value of the network it's spent to protect. In 2009, the Bitcoin network was worth very little to just a few people, so the electricity cost to transact 50 Bitcoin of Coinbase funds was extremely low. Today, earning the ability to transact 12.5 Bitcoin is worth spending around 100 exahashes of electricity per second. Everyone who joins the network in any capacity should recognize that roughly 14%, 3 million out of 21 million, of the value they are purchasing as of October 2019 is held by all participants in the network equally, only to be transacted by individuals submitting valid proof of work to order and secure transactions. This has all gone according to the set supply schedule since day one of Bitcoin, and nothing changes about the economic incentives of selling hashed electricity to the network in the future. The difficulty adjustment by design ensures that it is always profitable for the most efficient energy producers to sell their cheapest electricity to the Bitcoin network. It has been posited that machines and software can hold and transact with private keys. I'm positing that we have nearly 11 years of empirical evidence that the network itself has been holding and transacting Bitcoin, but instead of with private key signatures, it's in exchange for hashed electricity. It's not the number of Bitcoin that one party or another holds that matters. It's the value of the overall network that matters. And the value of the network can only grow by understanding that its monetary properties are sound. There are only 21 million Bitcoin. All or nothing. Bitcoin's innovation is absolute scarcity, accessible in a way that is borderless, neutral, and permissionless. This innovation is shockingly disruptive to all facets of human interaction, and it's this innovation that drives the increase in the value of the network over time. Bitcoin is its 21 million limit. At no time can its supply be anything other than 21 million, because that would go against what we currently know and understand about how the network functions, and would unsolve the problem of digital scarcity. Bitcoin was able to achieve absolute scarcity by its network architecture, which is designed to increase in decentralization over time and to actively reject the human desire to produce more supply of a highly demanded good. Increasing decentralization over time effectively crowdsources the decision of Bitcoin's total supply to the entire network of participants, with the basic assumption that a decentralized network of individuals will not choose to debase their own currency when each participant does not have access to seigniorage opportunities. As a result, the prudent full node operator, miner, and holder can all act under the assumption that the 21 million limit is non-negotiable. The knowledge of this disruption in scarcity is slowly surfacing organically via the free market and through the network of hodlers of last resort. But this whole experiment depends on the ossified foundation of 21 million with clear, neutral, and unchangeable rules about how people are able to transact. Because we voluntarily opted into this network, we can say that all 21 million Bitcoin already exist today, since the rules the network consensus follows dictate that the supply schedule must be upheld. The only difference between the accessible and inaccessible supply is who or what currently holds the value of the Coinbase Bitcoin, and how humans must compete to transact with either the Bitcoin tracked by the blockchain or the Bitcoin tracked by the block number behind proof of work and the difficulty adjustment. Digital scarcity is a pretty strange idea. The Bitcoin tracked by the blockchain are ultimately just ones and zeros and mathematical functions supported by economic incentives. The same holds true for the Coinbase transaction coins. The schedule is written into the software we run, and there can't be a scenario where an upcoming block contains a different numerical value of Coinbase coins because the social and technical consensus does not view that as Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the intersection between code and social consensus. Either all 21 million already exist, or none of them exist. There is no middle ground. Views presented are expressly my own and not those of Unchained Capital or my colleagues. Thanks to Parker Lewis, Nolan Johnson, and Michael Goldstein for reviewing and for providing valuable feedback. All right, that concludes Phil Geiger's from Unchained Capital blog piece, 21 million Bitcoin, all 21 million Bitcoin already exist. Let's hit our sponsor. I want to hit some commentary on this piece because I really enjoyed this one. Take a break real quick and we'll jump back into it. All right. So I think this is a really unique way to think about it. And I think Phil has a really good point in laying out his argument that there are simply multiple ways to transact and gain access to Bitcoin. If you really think about the full supply, so the basis, let's summarize just the general argument here, is that the 21 million Bitcoin limit is set in stone, and the design of the system is such that as decentralization increases over time, which it is absolutely set to do, I think those characteristics are, or that trend is absolutely critical, and that all the right engineering and architectural decisions were made to make that a reality. As it becomes more increasingly decentralized, that fact becomes more and more difficult to change. and it is critical to the social consensus. You've got a number of pieces by, like, I think there's one by Nick Carter that breaks it down. Ben Perrin, BTC Sessions guy, does an article on, like, how he defines Bitcoin maximalism, and why it's not about just blindly following Bitcoin. It's about following a set of very critical design decisions and rules, and that Bitcoin maximalism is a result of seeing that Bitcoin is the only one that is following those. Same with the economic incentive stuff. I think it's Nick Carter. I know Hasu. Hasu Fly or whatever the tag is. It's a little bit different on different platforms. But Hasu has one on what makes Bitcoin Bitcoin. Like, what are the actual rules? I think he breaks it down to four different rules. And it's like the inflation schedule. Well, not really the inflation schedule, the 21 million supply limit, the anybody can verify, the no censorship, like very defined and neutral rules about who can spend and you know, who can't. And what was the last one? I think it was confiscation. I think it was can't be confiscated, that those were separated out. But it was basically like four rules. This is in... Which one is this? I think this is Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract. I'm pretty sure that's the article. So I'll link to that one, and I'll try to find the one that Nick Carter does. I can't remember that one off the top of my head. But these are basically an attempt to define what it is that Bitcoin is in the social consensus. And the one that absolutely 100% lands in every single body, every single person's definition is what this article is about. The 21 million Bitcoin, end of story, no questions asked, not even a little bit contestable. And what's funny is that that's such an important and critical meme to what Bitcoin is, that even if, like in my consideration, like I read and I remain open to the possibility that the security model changes when this goes to a fee structure. And now I don't think that this is going to be detrimental to Bitcoin. I think it will work, and I think we have plenty of time and plenty of people thinking about how to maintain the infrastructure, and we have the demand. We've already seen fees rise, so I really don't think that this is a problem. But let's say it is, that if we need like an inflation tail to maintain security in 30 years or something like that, if that was the case, I would rather Bitcoin die as it is and us fork it to a new network with maybe even a different name. Because I think the connection of 21 million, I think it becomes, it's no longer what Bitcoin was as soon as there is any amount of Bitcoin over 21 million. It is not the same thing. And, you know, maybe that's necessary, and I'm okay with that. It's not Bitcoin anymore. End of story. And I feel like a lot of people would agree with me on that. But, you know, who knows? But that's just kind of the idea, is that 21 million is absolutely fundamental to what we think of as Bitcoin. And I really liked his little comment that essentially, for whatever reason, we changed that rule. What we have done is we have unsolved the problem of digital scarcity. That immediately upon abandoning this, even if it's for a supposed justified reason, is that we've killed the one thing that it did, like the fundamental element and the problem that it solved just got unsolved. I think that's a really good way of framing it when you're trying to talk about, well, what the nature of Bitcoin is. Why is it an innovation? What did it solve? What did it invent? And digital scarcity really is it. And that's why it can't be copied. You know, go back to Unchained Capital blog, has the best article on this, in my opinion, is Bitcoin Can't Be Copied by Parker Lewis. So that really digs into the concept if, you know, you want to kind of explore this a little bit further and you haven't listened to that one yet. But this article, the all 21 million Bitcoin already exist, is just a really interesting way to look at it because it really is, it's true that they're all there. They just have a different set of encumbrances. And the way I framed this, after I first read this article, I was like, oh shit, that's really interesting. Because the way I framed it is, and I like the way Phil proposes it, is that you can either sign with a private key, and then you have Bitcoin, or you have access or ownership of Bitcoin, or you can sell hashes to the network. That you measure electricity, and there's a little statistic or a little statement that he makes near towards the end, that right now the Bitcoin network is valuable enough to sell 100 exahashes of electricity. And I like that. That's a really fun way to frame it, of selling a measurement of electricity as an exahash, like weighing electricity in hashes for the Bitcoin network. That's really kind of neat and interesting way to think about it. But take a step back and ask about the encumbrances of Bitcoin. You can time lock Bitcoin, right? You can multi-sig Bitcoin. There's a lot of different restrictions you can put on Bitcoin in the network for how and who can spend it. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, you could, I wonder how that would work. I feel like you could probably right now essentially pay a fee into, well, no, the fee itself doesn't have an encumbrance. I don't know, maybe that wouldn't work. I don't know, but I'm just kind of brainstorming the way that you can encumber something. You could easily time lock. Oh, well, that's what you would do. You just time lock and anyone can spend. But you could time lock Bitcoin for 50 years. Well, that doesn't mean the Bitcoin doesn't exist yet. Bitcoin absolutely exists. It just won't be accessible for 50 years. How is that meaningfully different than what's in the block reward? It's just, there's a time delay and there's a very specific way, non-private key related, you sell hashes to the network. You sell your use of electricity to the network and you get paid in the reward. But it is locked and determined by a schedule that is embedded into the system. And those are simply the two ways. You either meet, the one way, really, the one way that you can get Bitcoin in the Bitcoin system, you can access it or transact with it, is by meeting the requirements of the system to spend them. And some of those requirements include the passage of time. There's another quote. I'll actually read this one because I had this saved. Quote, in this way, we can look at the value of the locked Bitcoin as though it is distributed and held equally by every participant in the network. This value is paid by the holders to the miners for submitting hashed electricity to the network at the market rate measured by the value of the network it's spent to protect. So I like this is because the way I like this is inflation is one of those things that's extremely hard to define and see exactly where the cost is coming from. And inflation is one of those things where, like, you tell people you're paying for this, but if they don't understand the inner workings of the monetary system, they don't feel it. They don't know it. Like, it's like stealing pennies out of somebody's purse every couple of days that are just, you know, like, falling into the bottom of the purse. They don't know it. It's not something that, it's so pervasive and sneaky, essentially, that the cost itself is extremely hard to define. But really what it is, it's a cost on everyone who is holding the currency, everyone who is saving in that money. And that's why having that cost be open-ended is so dangerous. Or, of course, having that cost defined by a committee or a banking elite or a group of corrupt and arrogant politicians, like the amount of moral hazard and the amount of corruption that could be fueled by having essentially you decide what's good for me to spend, is really crazy and insane at a whole nother level when you kind of step back away from it, and instead of assuming that what we have is correct, how would you ever design this to be resistant to corruption? That would never be included in my design, ever, ever, ever. So, but this, the network, it's the Bitcoin network, does not have an open-ended cost. It is absolutely 100% unshaking in exactly what it's willing to pay to protect the network. And all those holders are paying the price. They are the ones, they're going into the system knowing what the inflation is, knowing you can measure right now what the percentage of the value, demand being constant, will be taken or paid out. In fact, you are the node runners themselves and the participants in the network are by definition, because the value is coming from them, it's inflated value, so it's everybody who's holding the currency, they are the ones paying the miners. They've chosen a set of rules that that willingly take the supply, dilute the supply of their own holdings in order to protect the network. And this is part of why I don't think the fee model is going to be a problem, because we are paying the cost. It's just one of those things we don't see. So when, or it's a little bit harder to recognize, but in Bitcoin, it is much clearer. We pay these costs everywhere, even though there's not like an explicit bill being sent to us. And moving over to a fee model is doing that. Is it like, okay, here's the bill that you've been paying, but now we're just going to put it right in front of you. However, the value of your currency is no longer being diluted. So I can't see how it would be detrimental to the security of the network and the system if the cost is moved from spot A to spot B, when really what's all that's happening is that it's defined over in A and it's a little bit more strictly defined in B. Though it does become a system of transacting, being the major fundamental difference is that even if no one transacts, there is protection for the network. You have to transact for and pay the fee. So it's a little less the holders are paying for the fee and it's the users, it's the utilizers of the network. Well, holder is utilizing. All that aside, the people who are actually publishing data to the blockchain that are actually paying for the security in the future. So there will be, there's certainly a transition happening. I just don't see it being as fundamental as a shift that some suggest that it is. But I just really like the framing of that we are paying the miners right now. We that's what we do. And it's the holders and every participant who is part of this network are paying miners, and they're paying them in exchange for hashed electricity. All right. I think the only thing I really wanted to mention from this article that I thought was pretty unique as far as stuff I've read, like ideas that I've read, is that it said that it's been posited that machines and software can hold and transact with private keys, that, one day there will be computers making thousands of transactions and opening and closing lightning channels, and there will be a machine economy. That's what Balaji Srinivasan talked about a lot and was claiming he was trying to do a 21 Incorporated. I don't really know what the hell that's been going over there in a couple of years. But that was a big selling point and like a really big concept that I feel like he pioneered and got out there. And it's also something that's really, I think, very, very true. There will be machines. There will be a machine economy where one machine is paying for another machine based on the incentives and instructions of value assessment given to it by some human input. So like you essentially would give a computer a set of parameters to judge between A and B. And when there was a time or conditions in which a decision had to be made, it would check the parameters, if this, that, then sort of thing. And lay out, okay, well, this is the decision that I've got to make because I've got a couple of different options on the table, and this one is the clear winner here. But you'll have, combine this with much more complex scripting and value judgments and more complex tiers of parameters and incentives, and you've got the potential for something really incredible where computers truly are a driving force in the value and transaction capacity, not just in a, oh, well, we're running the nodes, the computers run the nodes, but in a actual decision making on the network. And I think really Lightning is proof of this, that Lightning wallets are already automatically opening and closing channels. Very, very soon they're going to be balancing channels themselves, and managing a lot of liquidity and a lot of Bitcoin transactions totally on their own. And I don't think we're too far away from proprietary systems that do this either, where some company specializes in, you know, an algorithm or a autopilot, quote unquote, that's just brilliant and works for so and so amount of capital very easily, and will, you know, save you tons and tons of money and headache and manual management of your finances if you just download our software and it will autopilot the shit out of all your channels for you. But anyway, so I think we've got an example already of the machine economy slowly coming about, and I think it won't be long until we add one machine providing a service to another machine, and machine markets trying to price and doing, you know, benchmarks on the quality and reliability of each of these services and like making these decisions. So we know that's coming, and I feel like that's pretty obvious. It's just gonna take a long time. However, as Phil says, we have 11 years of empirical evidence of it actually is happening, that the network itself is paying out Bitcoin. It is holding and transacting Bitcoin, except instead of using private keys, instead of using, you know, some custom set of parameters, it's using a public and open set of conditions, enabling it to sell Bitcoin for hashing electricity. And that just the framing, the best thing about this whole piece is just the framing of that you are selling, the Bitcoin network is selling Bitcoin to people for hashing electricity and measuring electricity in the number of hashes. I just think that's a really fun framing that I wanted to, you know, introduce, that Phil made available in this article. All 21 million Bitcoin exist, and the network is selling them to us. So we will close this here. Thank you so much for listening. Again, this was All 21 Million Bitcoin Already Exist by Phil Geiger at Unchained Capital. I've said it a ton of times, and now I'm just basically running through their whole blog, because all the pieces up there are great. I can't recommend it enough. Thank you to Unchained Capital for doing this. And now they're linking to, I've been talking with Phil, we've done a little bit back and forth on this article, actually. But it's been awesome to have them link to my audio versions from the website. And it's really cool to know that this is getting out to more people, and it's making their stuff more accessible, and it's making my stuff more accessible. So a huge thank you to those guys. They're a really interesting player in this space. And you know me, I love some good writing, and they always deliver. So don't forget to subscribe to Unchained Cap and Phil, what's Phil's Twitter tag? I will have that in the show notes. I do not have it. I think it's just Phil Geiger, if I'm not mistaken. Phil _ Geiger, and that's G-E-I-G-E-R, by the way. So you can check him out on Twitter and check out Unchained. I will have all this stuff available in the show notes, so you can check it out. Links to the blog, as well as all the other audio reads we've done from Unchained. More to come. Stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe. This is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. I am the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. Subscribe to the show. And if you want to help promote the autification, make sure that all the great pieces in Bitcoin get the audio versions they deserve, well, you can become a patron at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. You'll get in the Crypto Economy Telegram crew, and all that good stuff. We have a lot of fun over there, and as little as a dollar a month will get you in there. Just become a patron, support my work. It means so much, and thank you so much to everyone who does. We have a lot of fun in the Telegram crew, so and I can't thank everybody enough for making this possible and for supporting the show. I've got so many ideas that I want to do and ways that I want to expand this and change things and other stuff to do in the future, and it literally doesn't happen without you guys. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you hate Patreon to the core of you, which some people do, and you want to support the show in some other way, you can always donate Bitcoin. I've got the tippin.me on Twitter. I've got a Bitcoin address on the website. But of course, if you just want to... But the one thing that you can always do that won't cost you anything is to share this show out. Get it in front of more people in the Bitcoin and the crypto economy space so they too can hear all this great stuff, all the best articles, and of course, Guy's Take, which is the most important part of the show. So until next time, I love you all. Take it easy, guys.